Welcome to Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom, where wisdom comes from everywhere. This is a podcast about generational wisdom shared to help build a bridge for future generations and to build stronger communities through education, technology, and health. Welcome to Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom. Hola, hola, comunidad, and thank you for joining me today. You know, I just want to shout out to the folks that are sharing, that respond to us via email, how much they love this podcast, and also for signing up through our newsletter at latinasb2b.com. You are really making an impact to community by sharing and supporting us, so thank you for that. So today's episode, I want to get into some really critical elements of what's coming up in the next few months, and that is the voter election year. And we know that this can be a hard time for us to really say, I am not going to participate, or I don't know who to vote for. What I'm going to do in these next few months is really try to seed the information you need to know that you really do have power and accountability in your local, state, and federal governments. Because here's the deal. When you take away people's economic stability, which is their housing, right, and their ability to work, you are breaking down a community. So when we vote, that is the most powerful tool we have outside of a job, outside of working, outside of access to many things that we may not have, and also if you are in jail or incarcerated. That is a population that is also left out of the conversations of how we can hold accountability to our system here in the states and also federally, to those that are signing checks, that are giving funding, that are creating new housing. So let's think about those two very important dynamics in voting on policy and change for our community today. You know, the author Nicole Hannah Jones puts this succinctly in her book, The 1619 Project, which is banned in Texas and Florida. I can't stress enough the importance of this book to be read, or you can hear it through their podcast, or you can see it through Hulu for this election year. It's going to put all matters into perspective, beginning with racism, democracy, and capitalism, which was built on the backs of slavery, from the eradication to our indigenous populations for land ownership. So when we think about these things and what we're critically trying to vote on for our communities, there is a history and a legacy here that we cannot ignore. So today, it's no coincidence that the U.S. has the highest incarceration rate in the world. And women's incarceration has continued to grow exponentially faster over the last two decades. We have to consider the legacy of the prison system and who profits from the prison system, and the lack of jobs, the mental health, affordable housing, access to healthcare leave many on the margins to fail. So when we talk about systems, who were the systems built for and how can we change them? So voter access, civil engagement, and social justice policy leadership from our own community members is the core and the back to basics of how we can all do our part to help the community and this democracy of the U.S. thriving. So let's welcome our guest today. I am very excited to introduce Marlene Sanchez. We are incredibly honored to have Marlene on the podcast. She is the executive director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights here in Oakland, California. As the executive director, she is a proud San Franciscan native and Chicana, where she has spent more than 20 years building power with youth and formerly incarcerated people. Through her work, Marlene has created pathways to invest in leadership of people directly impacted by the criminal legal system and help center the voices of young people to bring youth justice. For the past decade, she has helped pass policies focused on youth justice, reproductive rights, LGBTQ discrimination, police accountability, and sentencing reform. Marlene came into community work at age 15, looking for employment and a way out of the juvenile justice system. She was first hired by Young Women's Freedom Center as a community health outreach worker,
And 10 years later, she is the executive director of that organization. So let's welcome Marlene Sanchez to Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom. So Marlene, let us talk about the Ella Baker Center here in the Bay Area. The Ella Baker is the Center for Human Rights. It supports a community that a lot of us are very much unaware of and how they affect everything from our economy to our policing system here in the United States, as well as, you know, economically, how a lot of families suffer from this incarceration and it breaks down communities. So welcome, Marlene, to the podcast today.
Thank you, Teres.
Thank you. So as the executive director for the Ella Baker Center, you know, I'd like us to learn a little bit about Ella Baker for those of us who don't know who she is from the civil rights movement, maybe pre-civil rights, and how she became an icon for the incarceration and the human rights of folks in this community.
Yes. So we are named after Ella Jo Baker, a civil rights hero, somebody whose work is something we really look up to and bring into the work of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights here in Oakland, California. Ella Baker's work in the civil rights movement, in SNCC, Ella Baker worked with the NAACP. Ella Baker was somebody who believed in building leaders who worked with young people and supported their leadership. Was also somebody who didn't get a lot of recognition in the civil rights movement, but we know was a backbone to a lot of the leaders that we do know about and that we've learned about. Ella Baker, one of the things that we admire the most of Ella Baker's teachings is that she believes in like the leadership of everybody, that everybody can be a leader, that it's not just about the charismatic leaders and the leaders that are out in front, but it is about all the different types of leaders and all the different roles that people play in the movement, from the administrative to the teachers to the mentors to like all the different roles. And Ella Baker played a lot of those roles. And really, you know, we definitely look to her for the way that we teach and the way that we think about leadership here at the Ella Baker Center. And so she's an icon. She's a shero. She's an inspiration. Even after she has transitioned into the ancestor world, she continues to be invoked as a huge source of inspiration for us. We literally ask ourselves, and many times when there's like hard times, we're like, what would Ella Baker do? And really, like, we find the answer.
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk about the community center there that's in Oakland, California. And it's a building that you were able to acquire to really help a lot of folks transition and build leadership into the community. But I want to hear more about your story into your North Star. Like, tell us about how you became involved in this work and then eventually end up being the first Chicana executive director of the Ella Baker Center.
Yes, happy to share more about what we're doing, because Ella Baker Center for Human Rights has been around for 26 plus years, almost there, reaching our 30. And around some of the same time that I've been organizing, I got involved. You know, I'm born and raised in the Mission District in San Francisco and got involved in community work through an organization called the Young Women's Freedom Center. And I really started doing work around HIV harm reduction in the 90s. That was an issue that we were facing that we still face today, but was really at the height of that epidemic. I did a lot of street outreach and HIV work and was a harm reduction practitioner at the age of 15. And during my time doing that, I was also dealing with the criminalization that I was facing in schools. My first time ever getting arrested and actually going to get fingerprinted and taken into a jail. I was 11 years old as I got in a fight in middle school. And the response to that behavior was to call the police, to call the gang task force, and to take me in for fingerprinting. And I like to share that experience because had I been a young person in a mostly white neighborhood, or if my family had money, I come from immigrant parents who were hardworking and worked multiple jobs and actually didn't even have the time to come to my school, not because they didn't care, but because they just couldn't. You know, the response to Latina from the mission was be in gangs. And so let's call the gang task force. And I always say my first introduction to gangs was in that meeting. I shortly after Googled, what is the gang task force? What do they do? And, you know, got information. And 2 years later, after that first arrest, I actually ended up joining a gang because I was like, you know what? They already think I'm in a gang. I'm being categorized as a gang member. I might as well actually have the protection and the support of a gang because, as we know, you know, gangs also provide that community that sometimes is lacking in our neighborhoods, those mentors, and, you know, may not be in such a positive way, but, you know, they provide that, you know, in the community. And so I later ended up doing just joining a gang. But I was also very lucky that I was also really I was introduced at the same time to community work. I was introduced to street outreach. I was certified as a pre and post HIV counselor because I was seeing everybody, most of the friends I knew, we all knew somebody who was HIV positive. Mm-hmm. And so we all knew somebody, whether it was an uncle, a friend, or, you know, it was either HIV or Hep C or who was on drugs. This was the height of the war on drugs, growing up in the 90s. And it was the same time we were also seeing a divestment from opportunities. After school programs were closing, schools were closing. Mm-hmm. Get a school counselor if, you know, and not at least, I had never met a school counselor when I was growing up. You know, we started to see over-policing of young people and criminalization of young people who were, you know, this was also the time of the super predator narrative, right? That these are the young people who you should be afraid of and not help. And these are Black and brown young people, poor young people from the same communities that I'm from. And I'm from San Francisco. And so our communities were very diverse. We were, you know, almost every neighborhood was targeted except for some of the more, you know, resource neighborhoods. And we know, right, from that the safest neighborhoods are also not the neighborhoods that have more police, but the neighborhoods that have more resources and more support. And the young people that actually thrive are those that, you know, get invested in and get supported and not just thrown into juvenile halls, because that just became a revolving door for me. At the age of 11 until about my early 20s, where it just became a revolving door. Everything I did, whether it was I was getting criminalized for being in my neighborhood, because we were also seeing gang injunctions. And I lived in the neighborhood that I was not allowed to be in, but I had nowhere else to go. So anytime I was seen walking down the streets by police, I was picked up if I was with young people that also look like they would, you know, shouldn't be in that neighborhood. Anyway, so that's a big part of my experience. And at the same time, I was also, you know, I had an incarcerated father who was given a 25-year sentence in the in 1989. He was given a 25-year sentence for drugs. And we know, again, what was happening at that time. My parents were factory workers and were constantly at risk for raids at their jobs. And my mom actually was picked up in a raid at her job. And, you know, my father learned quickly that it was actually safer to sell drugs than to stay working in the factory undocumented. And so that was, you know, what he chose in that moment. And so we were dealing with, you know, now also having, you know, a parent who was incarcerated, and my mom had to just take on more jobs to raise four kids on her own. And so, and I know my story is not unique because, It was the experience of many of my friends. Either your parents were incarcerated or they were on drugs or they were working so many jobs that, you know, we started to name ourselves the like the generation that had to like the self-parenting generation. Mm-hmm. And we started parenting ourselves. And so, but again, you know, I was also really lucky that I was able to build sisterhood. I was able to connect in community and feel like I had both sides, that like I was on one end by the system seen as like a throwaway kid who, you know, didn't, you know, that needed to be in juvenile hall. And on the other end, I was seen as an asset to my community and as a resource because I was bringing resources and life-saving supplies to people on the same blocks that I hung out in.
Yeah. And, you know, you bring up a very interesting point that that came on the height of, you know, the 80s and divestment into the 90s and the drug epidemic that happened. You know, they were divesting in communities, but what they weren't, you know, having, you know, any problem with was funding the policing in school systems, which grew exponentially during that time. And, you know, in California, they have funded, you know, up to billions of dollars in certain school districts to keep that going. So the prison to, you know, from school to prison pipeline is a very real thing. And it starts very early. So knowing that, you know, the U.S. has one of the highest incarceration rates in the world, and we know this, right? A lot of us have known about it through big talk shows that have mentioned it. And we talk about why is that happening? And I want to get your perspective on that because you have a lot of folks that come to the Ella Baker Center, but it's a critical understanding of why the economic piece, economic equity is like when you put the two together, you see the economic disparity that really impacts families, especially from your piece. And then also from, you know, communities that are trying to rebuild themselves, which you are very much a part of, Marlene. So can you share with us?
Yes, yeah. I will say that it's definitely not a coincidence, right? That during this time, we were seeing this divestment from public services and the safe, like, you know, taking away the safety net. And at the same time, we were seeing like almost like a double down on prison expansion. Mm-hmm. And we know that both private prisons and, you know, there is this huge incentive for privatization of prisons around this time too, so that they were giving corporations incentives to like start a prison and have prison labor. I mean, we know all knew like companies like Victoria's Secret. And I mean, there was like, oh, I'm not trying to like just point them out. I can't think of all of them. There was actually so many companies that benefited from prison labor. We also know that it's not that this country has basically been built on slave labor and prison labor, that we went from the slave trade to the prison trade, that this country, there are states that have been literally built on the backs of Black people, and that we continue to exploit and, you know, use prison labor today. I mean, the average hourly wage of somebody in prison is like 12 cents. Even lower, like 8 cents. I might be exaggerating when I say 12 cents. And so, you know, there is a huge, it's not about public safety. Mm-hmm. You know, the narrative out there that we need prisons to keep us safe is not true, because we also know from the research that somebody, and if we look at young people, right, the more a young person spends in one of these facilities and the longer somebody spends in prison, they have worse outcomes because they've been cut off from society. They've been cut off from their family. They've been, you know, there's a lot that contribute to that, that is less about somebody's ability to rehabilitate, but more of somebody's, like the further marginalized someone is and the longer they spend in these facilities, the worse the life outcome. And we know that it's not about public safety. It's about jobs for the prison union. It's about, you know, profitization of people. And it's about, you know, our lack imagination of what we do as a community when there's been harm. And I do think there are a lot of models out there that really point to things that have worked a lot better. And yet we continue to invest and expand this system of harm. And even when we look at talking to families who have had, like, you know, because it's when we look at like who's being harmed and like who is advocating for prisons, it's not always, I think they try to put the victims up front and center, but it's usually, you know, the victims, you know, and people who are survivors of crime also want justice and they want healing. And many times don't find it within a system that actually doesn't even ask them what they need.
Right.
Not provide any healing. And so yeah, it questions like, what is the purpose and what is the, you know, of the prison industrial complex? And it is mainly to like, you know, to fill the pockets of people who are profiting of continuing to profit off like they did off slavery.
Yep. It's something to acknowledge and also to understand how California in a lot of ways is also setting the pace and policy in transformation and restorative justice in that area. So I know that Ella Baker is part of that critical change and some of the wins that you have done for that in policy making, Marlene, which I think is wonderful. So can you share some of those wins with us and how they have impacted the lives of, you know, the state? Because there's some other things that are coming up that I'd like to talk about where this could really, just champion change across the nation.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a lot of victories over our almost 30-year existence, from fighting for jobs and holding police accountable. But in most recent years, we've had huge success in resentencing work, really challenging some of these sentences that were given out in the 80s and 90s, and during the time that I mentioned earlier around this like criminalization of young people, you know, they were giving out life without parole and they were giving out these gregarious sentences, knowing that people change, right? Mm-hmm. That like 20 years in prison, you're obviously not the same person that you were. And so we've been really working on opportunities so that people can find some pathways to release and some pathways to freedom. And that looks at kind of chipping away at these sentencing structures that just put people away for a really long time. And then most recently in the last 4 years, we worked on a pretty historic piece of legislation called the Racial Justice Act, because we know that this system is inherently racist, right? Mm-hmm. There's like, when you look at the history and where it comes from and the fact that it is just another version of slavery and a system of punishment and exploitation, then we also know, right, like the origins and kind of doesn't change. And so it is inherently racist. And so we worked on a piece of legislation that really challenges racial bias in every part of the system and in a
awesome.
Sense, some justice back into the justice system. Mm-hmm. And it looks at both retroactive. And so we've had some huge wins on cases where most recently a judge held some cops who pulled over two young men who were wearing hoodies and had their hoods over their heads. And even though they claimed like they didn't know the race of the people who they pulled over, the judge held that it was implicit bias and, you know, threw the case out. And, you know, there's some sense of hope that we no longer will have, yeah, that we have these actors in the legal system who basically have been able to get away for years with stereotypes and excuses of like racist acts, mm-hmm. because they claim like, well, it wasn't intentional. Well, this law makes it so that it doesn't matter if it was intentional or not. It is racist and it is biased. And we no longer want to see, you know, a, you know, where the color of your skin determines your fate in the system. And we know that it is still the case that if you are Black, you are more likely than your white counterparts to get tougher sentences, go to prison.
Yep.
And so, you know, so this is, so for us, you know, it's still a lot of work and figuring out, like, how do we implement it from, like, from right from when the police stop you to your sentencing. You know, there was another case where a judge threw out a case because the DA was using rap lyrics to claim that this person was violent. And, you know, and then it also gives us an opportunity to challenge gang enhancements because we know who gets gang enhancements. Like I shared earlier that, I mean, I was categorized as a gang member at 11 years old. It isn't the white kids in NOE San Francisco. It was the Black kids and the brown kids in poor neighborhoods in San Francisco. And so, and I know that that situation is happening all around the country.
Yeah. And so, you know, thank you for sharing that. So right now I know how this impacts a lot of community members, especially this is a big election year. And I want to talk about that. You know, incarcerated people do have the ability to vote. However, it is based on the charge in the prison system. California, you can vote. There are only two states in the nation. And the way the voting system is going and the narrative around that has really been polarizing. I just want to talk about voting access, and the vote is very important this year. And what is your take on, you know, we're not talking about the people that are up for voting. We're talking about just voting in general.
Yeah. Well, I will say that, like, voter suppression has historically tried to keep Black and brown people and poor people from exercising their right to vote. We saw this in 2020, saw voter suppression happening. We continue to see voter suppression happening with the lack of language access, disability access, more voter suppression and intimidation and discriminatory policies, like, you know, not allowing certain people to vote because they're in prison. In California, if you are not in prison, which and you're in a county jail, even if you do have a felony, you can vote. And that has been something that groups like, you know, All of Us or None and Initiate Justice and just, like, name so many other groups, including, you know, EBC and a few other groups have been fighting for years to restore the right to vote. And we've made some changes in California, but it doesn't go far enough. We now have folks can vote while they're in county jail. But again, you know, there's all these ways in which disability access and other ways that really transportation, childcare. I mean, there's all these ways that just, like, really prevent people from voting, misinformation, and also just access. If you're in county jail and nobody brings you a ballot, you can't vote. They're not. Right. So we are currently working on some administrative changes to make sure there's, like, actual access to voting in the jails and just, like, the potential of being able to influence an election if we get our folks the access to vote, the information, and just the give them the ballot and help them and support them in casting their votes since they can't access it any other way is really important. At EBC, we're targeting voters who typically aren't targeted by voter engagement strategies. This year, we're launching a whole bunch of programs, which I'll mention. And, you know, we've been going in neighborhoods where we've been told, like, wow, nobody's come here. And so that has been our focus, is focusing on the voters who are least likely to vote for many reasons, who are least resourced and who are least engaged in the political process and quite honestly don't trust the political process for valid reasons. Having conversations with people about what this election really means for our communities and the importance of us making our vote count. And that includes people who also can vote. We're talking to incarcerated people. We're talking to immigrant communities. We're talking to people who we know, like, maybe they can vote, but their kids can vote.
Right.
When you go into households of, like, immigrant families, you're talking to whole communities. they may not be voting, but best believe that information is getting to the village. And so we are not leaving them out of this, of our civic engagement program. We are talking to even those who we know don't vote and can't vote. But again, really prioritizing building the block of voters who are impacted by the very issues that EBC is working against, which is mainly formerly incarcerated people, their families, their communities, and then really just educating our constituency and getting them active. For us, political power is not just about the day you cast your vote, but your involvement in the political process, your ability to understand what is happening and what is at stake. And so for us, it's that deep engagement and that political education. And so we do have an event coming up on May 22nd. It's a relaunch of our membership. May 22nd, it starts at 5:30 p.m. It'll happen at the Ella Baker Center, the building you mentioned, at 1419 34th Avenue. I can drop the link so that you can share it out. But please sign up. And if you can't make the membership meeting, you should still sign up to be a member, because you'll get information about what's happening in your local community. You'll get information about what's happening across the state, and you'll get information about what's just happening nationally.
So this summer, you're hosting a summer engagement relaunch for the community, right? But will it be online, Marlene? And can you tell us just briefly what that will be about?
Yeah, so we are relaunching our membership program. Our membership program is national. You can be anywhere in the world and join our membership. It will be hybrid, and so you can join virtually or you can come to our building at 1419 34th Avenue on May 22nd at 5:30 p.m. You can also just sign up to be a member and join different activities that are happening locally across the state and nationally. In August, there'll be some national opportunities as well. Mm-hmm. Our political organizing program is an 8-week paid political organizing opportunity for people.
That's awesome.
Yes, for people who want to get out the vote, register people to vote. We want to have parties. If it's your first time voting, we want to celebrate you.
Awesome.
Bring your friends along, you know, vote together. Mm-hmm. Vote in little clusters, and definitely there'll be some opportunities. Visit our website for more ways to sign up for the membership and get involved.
Yeah. This year, I know we say it every year, but this is really the most important election year of our lifetime. And it is very critical that all community members try to come together to just try to get people activated to even cast a ballot. And, you know, it's really going to have a lot of consequences based on what's at stake. And the communities today really need to be built up. And I think the Ella Baker Center is really just a beacon of hope and light in, you know, our communities here in the Bay Area. So, Marlene, tell us a little bit about, on your way out, we will have all the links. But what would you like to say to the community or in the audience, you know, really about, you know, leaving us with, like, you know, some knowledge into, like, what we're heading into, you know, for communities to be powerful, because voting has a lot of power. It always has.
Yes. And if you are looking, I guess what I will say is, if you're looking for a political home somewhere where you're going to get political education and information about what's happening, I know that we are the political home for many people who are currently incarcerated, formerly incarcerated, just have loved ones who've been impacted by police violence and also incarceration. We know that mass incarceration and just incarcerating more people and adding more police does not always result in more safety for our communities. We know we are all concerned about safety. I'm a mother of three, and I'm always concerned about safety, and I know that what safety looks like is affordable housing for communities in the Bay Area. There are many families who no longer can afford to be here, who are being pushed out. I know safety looks like you know, well-resourced teachers in our school.
Yes.
Our kids can learn in a safe environment. It looks like mental health services. You know, we forgot that like a pandemic just happened and we have a lot of people who still have food insecurity and who are suffering of mental health. And we have to be more creative about what the solution to public safety is, because incarceration and policing shouldn't be the default to safety. And so I think that that's the message I would leave people with, that in order for us to be safe, we must fight for the very things we know our communities deserve. And we want you to join us in our quest for that liberation and that safety. And we know that we can't do it alone. We need all of us. Whether you've been impacted or not, we need everybody at the table. We need you talking to your neighbors about some of the, there's going to be a very scary ballot measure on the books that I'm actually not as prepared to talk about right now, but just be aware and be on the look for these ballot measures that are going to sound really nice. They're going to sound like, oh, this is going to prevent theft, or this is going to prevent homelessness. But when you read the proposition, it will increase prison time. It will make it easier to incarcerate homeless people. It will, like, you know, it'll add to more of the like policing and the very things we know we actually don't want our money going to. Our government is also, you know, having hard budget times, and we can't continue to pour money into a system that is already over-resourced, that doesn't have good outcomes. So why do we keep putting money in things we know don't work? Because all of us know like what works. I trust the very community and all of you who are listening here that like, you know what works best for your community. And I actually have not met yet a community member that says in my community, you know, prisons were the solutions, you know? And so, but that has been the default to public safety. And I do believe, you know, mass incarceration is a public safety issue that we all need to be fighting against.
Yes, 100% agree with that. And I appreciate those words because, again, we are in a critical moment. And I just support the Ella Baker Center, as you know, and I'm so privileged to know you, Marlene, from the Latina cohort group that we were in. So we will have all the information in the show notes. And if you'd like to reach out to Marlene, you can find her on LinkedIn and also through the Ella Baker Center. So thank you for joining us today, Marlene. We will have to have a part two about these coming up bills that you're supporting so we can get more folks involved. And I really like the open invitation globally to join the Ella Baker Center here. The Bay Area is known for many movements, and California does set the pace in providing a lot of community change. So let's not stop that. And let's, you know, bring it all the way to Georgia, because, you know, that's going to be a critical element again this year. So
definitely would love to come back and share about some of the harmful, really some of the bad ballot measures that are going to be in front of people this year. And really just doing a little bit of just education so that we are all aware on the way that they're going to sneak in these really terrible things.
And that's why we need more community leaders to run for local office. Yes. That is a big deal. So, you know,
vote for you, Teresa.
Oh, no, I will vote for you, lady. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on Latinas from the Block. Definitely to the boardroom you are going and have been. And we are going to invite you back. So gracias, Marlene. Yeah. Muchas gracias. Well, and I will see you soon. Gracias, Marlene, for joining us today on Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom. Again, if you would like to participate in this voter election and become a member of the Ella Baker Center here for human rights globally, you can go to their website at ellabakercenter.org and sign up for their membership. What that does is brings you into their newsletter and also the civic engagement, where they can teach you about how to get people activated in your community to vote. Also, let's not forget, that if this is your first time and you would like to participate in getting the vote out, they will train folks out there so that you can get paid to do the work to get people registered so that they participate in this voter year, which is very critical. Again, that's the ellabakercenter.org. All right. And also, we'd like you to participate in signing up for their community events. If you're in the Bay Area, you go to ellabakercenter.org and look under events. If you'd like to learn more about Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom, please reach out to us at info@latinasb2b.com and sign up for our newsletter, where you'll find out more about events, workshops, and webinars that we'll be hosting throughout the year with our podcast guests and allies that wish to share their information and platforms that they are building today or policies that they are creating to help transform the nation for a better democracy. If you'd like to learn more about how you can work with Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom in a sponsorship opportunity or networking event, please reach out to us at info@latinasb2b.com. Gracias.